From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The Nigerian government is always looking for people, you know, to blame when it fails in its responsibilities. And when there's a problem in the Delta, it's always the people.
The Niger Delta is on fire again. Another pipeline explosion in Nigeria kills hundreds. A feminist activist from the Delta speaks out. Also, a look at women and AIDS with a live report from the International AIDS Conference in Durban, South Africa. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Philadelphia officials may reopen the 99-year-old Holmesburg prison to hold protesters arrested during the Republican National Convention. This according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. The maximum security prison, which was closed in 1995, could handle an overflow of detainees if space is not available at police headquarters, criminal justice center, or local Philadelphia police stations. The prison is in northeast Philadelphia. The deteriorating facility was the site of Philadelphia's worst prison uprising. Overcrowding and racial strife led to a July 4, 1970 riot that injured 117 prisoners and guards. When it closed, U.S. District Judge Norma Shapiro, who presided over a prison overcrowding case that helped lead to Holmesburg's demise, called it a happy day for the city of Philadelphia. It has since been partially maintained for filmmakers seeking dungeon-like settings. Holmesburg is also known for being the site of experiments on prisoners conducted by prison officials in conjunction with doctors at the University of Pennsylvania. Hundreds of prisoners were used to test products from facial creams and skin moisturizers to perfumes, detergents, and anti-rash treatments. Other experiments used the prisoners as test subjects for far more hazardous, even potentially lethal substances such as radioactive isotopes, dioxin, and chemical warfare agents. These experiments were exposed in a recent book by Alan Hornblum, who'd worked at the prison, called Acres of Skin. Emergency workers continue to pull corpses out of the stinking muck of a mountain of garbage that collapsed in the Philippines on Monday. At least 122 people are known to have been killed. Officials estimate about 170 people are missing. Unofficial reports fear as many as 300 people dead. The collapse of Manila's main garbage dump crushed a collection of shacks occupied by desperately poor people who pick through the garbage to collect items they can sell. Philippines President Joseph Estrada is promising a safer garbage system for Manila. He says bidding will be held next week for a new city waste management system that would no longer dump unprocessed garbage. Most of the dead so far are young children who scavenge the dump to find scraps both to eat and sell. Amnesty International announced this week there was yet another massacre in Colombia. The group says on July 8th, six men were killed. 63 families of the community of La Union have begun to flee their homes. On that same day, approximately 20 hooded men had entered the village, which is part of the peace community of San Jose de Apartado. This community has been struggling to resist the forcible displacement that has become commonplace in Colombia. According to Amnesty, the soldiers searched each house in La Union and took the inhabitants to the center of the village where the men were separated from the women and children. After shooting the six men, the community was then ordered to leave. Just days before, a large number of Colombian army troops were seen marching along the road near the village. Over 60 members of the community have been killed by members of the Colombian army, their paramilitary auxiliaries, and by the FARC since March 1997. Yesterday, green groups in Eastern Europe and former Soviet Union strongly opposed U.S. budget proposals to push agricultural biotech in their region. The United States is looking to allocate at least $30 million to promote U.S. agrobiotechnology in the former countries. Additional funding is earmarked for technical exchange programs for foreign officials to teach them about the U.S. regulatory system, quote, to approve agricultural products using biotechnology. The budget proposals are going before the U.S. Senate for their third reading during the next Senate session, which started this week. Environmental groups in Eastern Europe are outraged that their country should be targeted for the promotion of agrobiotechnology. Ukrainian activists are outraged that after the crimes of Chernobyl, this newest hazardous technology of Monsanto is coming into their country. The Russian socio-ecological union based in Moscow yesterday said that corporations like Monsanto are paying Russian institutes to do the trials of the Roundup Ready soybean and completely bypassing the standard Russian regulatory system. Fiji's two-month-long hostage crisis appears to be near a close today with the release of nine captives, but ominous signs exist of civil order unraveling elsewhere in the Pacific Island nation. Rebels freed nine of the 27 hostages they've been holding in parliament for nearly 2 months, raising hopes that the government crisis is nearing an end.
And Africa. Today your blood tears are falling as you struggle to discover just who you are in our world. Despotic traitors squeeze your new lands. Foreigners invade you while droughts torture you. But I'm sorry, Africa. I'm sorry for my people. I'm sorry what they left to you. Oh, sorry, Africa.
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 You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, Tony Bird singing from his CD, Sorry, Africa. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we're going to continue our look at the 13th Annual International AIDS Conference taking place this week in Durban, South Africa. Earlier this week at the conference, a panel of international experts released statistics predicting that life expectancies in some African countries will soon drop below age 30 because of the staggering number of AIDS deaths. This, as the U.S. Census Bureau says, that for perhaps the first time in their history, some nations in Southern Africa will experience negative population growth as a result of the disease. Nearly three-quarters of the 34 million people living with AIDS resides in sub-Saharan Africa, and deaths are increasing at a rate that scientists would have found incomprehensible only a few years ago. Since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, an estimated 11.5 million people have died of the disease in sub-Saharan Africa. 5,500 now die of AIDS every day. But researchers predict that about 13,000 will die daily by the year 2010. AIDS now accounts for about a fifth of all deaths in the region, with malaria a distant second at 9%. We go now to Durban, South Africa, where our guest is joining us. Bob Lederer is a senior editor at PAWS magazine and an activist with the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bob Lederer.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, through the miracle of ISDN, you sound like you're sitting in the studio with me in New York, but in fact, where are you?
I'm in the media center of the International Conference Center here in the very modern city of Durban.
Well, Bob, at the end of the program, we're going to be joined by two women AIDS activists. But before we go to them, I want to just get an update from you on what has happened over the last few days since the opening ceremony on Sunday night.
Yes, well, on the local front, the holding of the first ever International AIDS Conference in Africa has generated tremendous media coverage right here in both the city of Durban and the country as a whole. And there's been daily front page stories, and today's follows right in the vein of the statistics that you read a minute ago, with a big black headline, AIDS will end black majority. And it reads, the AIDS epidemic could turn the black majority into a minority in South Africa. Minister of Welfare and Population Development Zola Skiwewa-Yiwa has warned. He said that the fact that AIDS was associated with poverty was an unpopular truth that needed to be faced. Quote, the truth is this disease is associated with poverty, and in South Africa, poverty faces black people. The effects of AIDS will turn us into a minority. And so that kind of sets the climate for everything else that goes on inside these corridors here among the scientists and doctors and activists that are gathered for numerous scientific and social and political discussions. And among those social and political discussions, the number one issue continues to be the question of access to the medications that have proven so effective for people in late-stage disease in Western countries that have the resources to afford them. And in that vein, the Nobel Prize-winning medical organization Doctors Without Borders has released a report here in Durban demonstrating how some developing countries have already significantly reduced the prices of AIDS drugs and suggested steps to replicate and expand upon these successes. And in particular, they cite the example of Brazil, which has made AIDS drugs affordable to tens of thousands of people who would otherwise go untreated because they could not afford branded products. And the key here was the in Brazil has been the production of generic products that are not following the patents of the U.S. and European-based pharmaceutical industry. In the same vein, the groups of ACT UP activists from New York, Philadelphia, and Paris have been very active in continuing to advocate very strongly for the expansion of efforts to make generic drugs available. And yesterday there was a loud demonstration during the speech by the head of the World Health Organization, former Norwegian Prime Minister Gro Brundtland, and they shouted medication for every nation and lay down in the corridors of the hallway where she, of the conference where she spoke, charging that the World Health Organization has sidelined efforts to make generic drugs available and has not followed through on its stated goal of having these drugs bought in collective bulk purchases that would actually drive down the prices and make a lot of countries have access to these drugs. And in fact, this whole question of whether drugs can be made affordable is resonating through many different conference sessions. There are debates that have been formally set up by this conference over whether whether drugs should be made available when there are not modern medical facilities in certain countries. So it's a very major topic. The other topic that is starting to come up more and more is about the role of the international debt that the poor countries face to the Western countries and Western banks, and how that's impeding freeing up the resources needed to develop programs against AIDS. And this afternoon, when the U.S. government officials were holding a reception to talk about their work on, in the AIDS issue, ACT UP and the local chapter of Jubilee 2000, which is the worldwide movement primarily religious-based for the cancellation of all debt to poor countries, is holding a demonstration outside the reception at which Sandra Thurman, President Clinton's AIDS advisor, and the Surgeon General David Satcher, as well as the U.S. Ambassador to South Africa, will be attending. And the ACT UP activists are saying, quote, poor countries are being destroyed by crushing debt payments. The United States has led the G7 to attach new harsh economic adjustment programs to a false debt forgiveness package. The United States is killing people with AIDS. And there will be a speaker this afternoon who is a longtime anti-apartheid activist and Nelson Mandela's authorized biographer Fatima Mir, who's active in the local Jubilee 2000 chapter. And finally, in the face of these protests, the World Bank has been present here at this meeting, has been holding press conferences, praising their own programs, their increasing packages of loans for AIDS programs, claiming that they will not add seriously to the debt of these countries, but in fact they are loans and not grants, and not really making any changes in the harsh conditions that they've attached to these continued loans and their other programs, which require fees for healthcare clinic people attending healthcare clinics and continued cutbacks in government programs as a whole. Finally,
yes, your final point, Bob.
Yeah, finally, the major aspect of AIDS care for for 85% of the world's people is traditional healing, and that has been almost completely excluded from the conference proceedings. And so in order to dramatize that exclusion and make a call for attention and resources to be directed to those sorts of healing, there was a march today outside the conference hall led by African healers and joined by people from Asia and South America as well, demanding that there be the recognition legally of traditional healing, which has a long pedigree in many countries and has been increasingly showing scientific results for benefiting people with HIV who have opportunistic infections. And so I think we're going to see more and more look at the role that traditional healing can play in a partnership with modern medicine in providing some hope to people living with AIDS in poor countries.
Well, Bob Lederer, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll keep the line open because we hope to be speaking with two women from the International Media Center, one from Africa, one from the United States, at the end of the program. Bob Lederer speaking to us from Durban, South Africa, the 13th Annual International AIDS Conference. But we're going to move north now from South Africa to Northwest Nigeria, to Northwest Africa. We're moving to Nigeria. As U.S. consumers worry about the rising cost of gas, Nigerians are paying a much heavier price. A pipeline explosion in the Niger Delta on Monday killed an estimated 250 villagers near the southern Nigerian town of Wari. This explosion occurred just miles from the Niger Delta town of Jesse, where about 1,000 people died in a similar explosion in 1998. Descriptions in the papers today, more than 100 charred bodies, many of them children in school uniforms, lay under clouds of oily smoke after this damaged gasoline pipeline exploded, launching flames that incinerated villagers. The story of these pipelines is what we want to look at today. Many of them old and leaky, go unfixed by multinational oil companies that use them to extract their wealth from Africa's most populous country. When these explosions happen, the corporate media, the Nigerian military regime, and oil corporations accuse thieves and vandals of being responsible. The press accounts almost always leave out the fact that many of the Delta's pipelines are rusty and corroded, go unrepaired by oil companies like Shell and Chevron and Mobil. These accusations of thieves and vandals against the people of the Delta are being used to create an increased military presence there. In fact, in a Washington Post piece today, toward the end of the piece, it says residents said many villagers who survived the inferno had gone into hiding for fear of being arrested as gasoline thieves. In past pipeline explosions, even seriously burned people have hidden out of fear, dying in their villages before medical workers were able to locate them. Joining us in the studio here in New York is a young activist from the Niger Delta, who Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill and I spent time with when we were reporting on Chevron's involvement in killings of environmentalists in Nigeria in 1998. And it's really great to see you again, Annie Brisby.
Thank you very much.
Annie Brisby is the president of the Niger Delta Women for Justice. We traveled through the Niger Delta with you, Annie, 2 years ago. What is your response to this latest horror, the killing of, well, hundreds of people, it looks like, in this town right near the oil city of Wari?
It's a very common occurrence in the Delta that whatever happens in the Delta, whatever negative problems in the Delta, is always blamed on the people. And the ineffectiveness of the government of Nigeria is always an issue, you know, and at the end of the day, they say it's the people of the Delta. And we know that the oil pipelines in the Niger Delta region have been there for over 40 years, and some of them have not been changed. Even what the activity that happened, I mean, the inferno that happened in Jesse, nobody has been arrested till date, you know, as regards who caused, you know, who broke the pipelines. And now we know that a lot of children, school children, died in this inferno, and still they say it's the people. You know, it's always the people, and the school children are now the people. What will school children be doing at that point, I mean, at that place?
Often reading the corporate media is like reading the press releases of the oil company or the Nigerian government. I remember with just, say, 2 years ago, the president of Nigeria was flown in a Shell helicopter, and he landed and said that there would be no compensation because the pipeline bursting was caused by thieves. So they had no proof of this. In fact, people talked about a motorcycle that had sparking this. And the articles and the AP reports actually said the vandals, mainly children, were found, and the proof of that they were vandals, the vandals, mainly children, with their charred bodies, their hands still holding cups. Why do people go to these pipelines, though they've complained about them being leaky with cups and any kind of containers?
The Delta region, I mean, it's very common that the pipelines are barred. The government knows the pipelines are bad. The oil companies know the pipelines are bad. And these pipelines are in the farmlands and very close to houses of the local communities. And when people go to the farm, they even sit on these pipelines because, I mean, they have to rest. You know, it just runs through their farmlands. And when we have a leak or a leakage somewhere, it's always saboteur. It's always criminals. They never want to take responsibilities. If we have people that have vandalized the pipelines, I mean, it's the duty of the Nigerian government to look out for those people who they claim have vandalized pipelines, but not at the end of the day generalize and leaving the multinationals who do not want to take responsibility for the bad pipelines in the Niger Delta region, and of course the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, which under normal circumstances all they wait for is a profit, but not necessarily maintenance. Nobody maintains anything in the Delta, but all profit.
Annie Brisby, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. Annie is president of the Niger Delta Women for Justice here in the United States with a group called Global Youth Connect. And we're going to be joined by other young people from around the world when we return here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, in a room filled with people who have come to the United States from around the world because of a group called Global Connect. On Democracy Now! Over the past months, we've covered the growing anti-globalization movement that's been gaining momentum here in the U.S. and around the world, from the battle in Seattle to the showdown in Washington, D.C. at the IMF World Bank meetings. Coming up, the Democratic and Republican conventions this summer, we will be there bringing you the protests on the streets and going into the corporate suites as well. Well, at the forefront of the what we'll call the unconvention, that is not the official convention or the shadow convention where nonprofit groups will be talking about issues of campaign finance, but the unconvention, the people in the streets. At the forefront of these movements are young people. Throughout history, young people have been at the fore of the various struggles for social justice, particularly in the developing world. Well, today we're going to talk with some of these young activists from around the world who have been brought into the United States by the group called Global Youth Connect. Annie Brisby is one of them, president of the Niger Delta Women for Justice. Annie, you're talking about the latest horror that took place in the Niger Delta. We don't know how many lives this latest oil pipeline explosion will ultimately claim. It looks like at least more than 200. What are the issues you're focusing on now in the Niger Delta?
We are focusing on poverty alleviation and community awareness. And in aspect of community awareness, we're also dealing with community mobilization and community dialogue. we've been doing right from 1998 with the Ijaw Youth Council and Kaema Declaration. We're still trying to create awareness as regards, because it looks like because of the democracy, a lot of things, you know, there's this notion that things have changed. But things are worse off, because we know sometime last year, in November last year, a whole community called Udi was wiped out by the Nigerian government, where over 3,000 people were killed.
Where?
That's in Udi, in Bayelsa State. It was wiped out by the Nigerian government.
Wait, you're talking about the new Nigerian government?
Yes,
of
but President Olusegun Obasanjo.
And how exactly was this area wiped out?
The claim that seven criminals killed policemen. And Obasanjo told the Bayelsa State governor to release the criminals. For Christ's sake, how will the governor know where, in a community where you have over 5 million people? And he said the governor should bring out the criminals. And he was like, I don't know what you're talking about, but the police will do something about it. He gave him 2 weeks ultimatum to bring out the criminals. And where he couldn't bring out the criminals, he sent in the troops into the community. And it was like more than 6-trailer load of combined team of military, the military, that's the Nigerian Army, the police, the Air Force, and the Navy. They even had the helicopter, you know, just going round and round the community. All the buildings, including the Niger Delta Wetland Center's building, the resource center, was also wiped out. All the buildings were wiped out. And every living thing in that community, the target was kill every living thing in that community. And that was exactly what the Nigerian soldiers did.
Under the so-called democratic president.
Under the so-called democratic president.
And you come from Bayelsa State in the south of Nigeria.
Exactly.
Is there any connection between what happened there and the oil economy and the oil corporations?
We know that in Bayelsa State, general, Bayelsa State is one of the largest sections. I mean, one of the it produces about 35% of the nation's oil, and it has more oil wells than the other states in the Niger Delta region. And in Odi, we have three oil wells owned by Shell. Right now, not in operation. It's just locked, owned by Shell. And the defense minister in Nigeria made a statement. He said, they are in a position to protect the multinationals and the facilities of the oil companies. And they will do anything to protect the multinationals and the facilities of the oil companies. And that was the reason why Odi was destroyed. This was a statement he made on the press, you know, after the destruction of Odi.
What kind of response has there been from the Nigerian people, and particularly people in the Niger Delta?
Right now there is a case in court by the Huri Laws, that's Olisa Bakoba, the senior advocate of Nigeria, who was the president of the Civil Liberties Organization in coalition with the Odi Coalition Against Genocide. And a human rights activist, Femi Falana, Femi Falana was there, Olisa Bakoba, Abdul Oro of the Civil Liberties Organization, Oronto Douglas, Felix Tuodol, and a host of other human rights activists from the Delta, went in there because during the destruction, the soldiers were there for about 2 weeks. Nobody could go in there, you know. And the Senate president, the Nigerian Senate president, Okadigbo, was the first person to visit the site after the soldiers, you know, packed out most of the bodies and dumped in River Non. And when he got there, he was like, the fact speaks for itself. And it was all over in the papers of the newspaper. He couldn't say a word. The place was stinking. Bodies everywhere, children, pregnant women, men. You know, and the reaction, the case in the court right now, there's been a lot of reaction for the rebuilding of Odi, for the compensation. And, of course, the activists in the Delta are pursuing the legal case in court. And we are more like very uncomfortable with the judiciary system in Nigeria, because it's like it works hand in hand with the Nigerian government. But we hope to move much more than further than that.
And what is it like to be an activist, a feminist, an environmentalist working in the Niger Delta?
Well, it hasn't really been easy, considering the fact that there's a lot of risk in our job in the Niger Delta region. Because most times you always hear the security report of the State Security Service coming after you. But the most important thing is, it's either you are dead or you are alive. because we have a cost. The Delta is our region. If without the Delta, we don't have a home. I can stay in Lagos State because I won't be accepted as a Lagosian. I can stay in the North because I won't be accepted as a Northerner. So we need to defend our environment. We need to defend our culture. And our people are our people. And we don't do it, nobody will do it for us. So,
what do you think when you hear about the people's concerns in the United States about oil prices, gas prices going up, you know, sort of going past $2 a gallon or something like that?
I mean, it's very interesting when we hear such things, because for us, the issue is not even the aspect of whether the price goes up or whether the price comes down. The point is the environment. And like you know, Amy, the price of oil, even in the Delta, is more expensive than even in the local communities. The price is more expensive than even in the cities. So the people have actually, like, you know, it's more like normal. They suffer more. So when we hear about price increase, like you increase the prices in America, that's how the prices in Nigeria increased. Knowing full well that we're one of the largest exporters of oil to America.
It's quite a remarkable fact that people can't afford gas and oil in Nigeria, one of the largest oil producers. Annie Brisby, we're also joined by Vandria Thompson, who is from Jamaica, working with the non-governmental organization Children First, which caters to the needs of street children and children from poor communities. Also, Katerina Charapaka from the Ukraine, an activist with International Women's Rights Center, La Strada, Ukraine, working on the problem of trafficking in women from the Ukraine. How serious is this issue, Katerina?
Okay, good morning. And this year is really serious in Ukraine, but it's not only Ukrainian problem. It's an international problem as well. Our La Strada program is an international project which includes such countries as Czech Republic, Bulgaria, Poland, and Netherlands. And in these countries, the problem is really serious also. And the reason of this situation is really a difficult economical situation. It's hard to find job for women, especially for women. And they got information about, well, how it's a good to live abroad and what kind of life is abroad. And they believe, really believe it. And that's why they go abroad to find some job.
Ukraine is now a country in transition to a so-called free market economy. How does that affect women?
You see, it's really affects women because of this transition situation. There is a renovating, rebuilding, or different economic establishments or anything. Well, and in this situation, it's hard to find a job in women, and they feel themselves less powerful and less respected because, if woman has a children, she probably the employer doesn't want to hire her. And if she hasn't, he also, or she, it can be, also doesn't want to hire her because she will have children in the future and there will be a problem. If she has children, there are a problem. If she's too young, there can be a problem because she won't think about her work but about something else. And if she's has a big family, it's the same.
Katerina Charapaka, how old are you?
22.
And how did you get involved in the fight against, dealing with women involved with sex trafficking in Ukraine?
I just know that there is an organization which deals with this problem. But before this time, I haven't had any thought about this problem. Of course, I realized that, yes, it can be, it exists, really exists, but I never thought deeply in this problem. And I started to work as a volunteer at the hotline. It's an informational hotline for people who are going abroad for any purpose, to work, to study, to visit friends, marry, or something something like this. And then I started to learn more and more, and it's really impacted me.
You're a student at the National Pedagogical University.
Yeah.
Most of the people there, 95%, are women.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have, among our university, among our groups, we have such different talks about problems with a job and possibilities to find job, and it's really serious problem.
Vandra Thompson, where do you come from in Jamaica?
St. Catherine.
And where is St. Catherine?
St. Catherine is actually closer to Kingston, which is in the capital. It's actually in the middle of Jamaica, really. That's where I'm from.
And how old are you?
I am 21 years old.
And talk about the issue that you're involved with, street children.
All right. The issue of street children in Jamaica is a major problem because there are a lot of kids on the street who have not been to school, have not gotten any form of education, don't know about their rights as children. And what I'm involved in is a process whereby we empower these youths to give them an education, give them basic skills so they can make an impact within their community. Also, we streamline them within the formal school system and monitor them. We are also into the whole process of child's right education, where we inform them about their rights as children, empowering them to make positive contributions to society.
Why is there, why are there street children?
There are street children in Jamaica because due to the low socioeconomic problems, also the fact that most households in Jamaica are single-parent household headed by females, and the females do have to work to support the family. And in some cases, they have four, five, six kids, and they have to go and work, so the other youngsters also have to go and hustle on the street so that the family can survive.
So what do you specifically do?
All right, we cater to the needs of the street, but I, in general, interact with the youngsters on a daily basis, whereby we provide remedial education, counseling, skills training for them, and also recreational activities, because we have found out that these youngsters, because they are on the streets, they do not get a chance to have fun or be a normal child. So we provide these opportunities for these youngsters, then get them back within the formal school system and monitor them.
How does the problem of street children in Jamaica relate to the U.S. economy?
All right. The issue of street children is a global one, right? And how it relates to America in that youngsters from our country would like to come to the America in terms of getting a qualified certificate and that kind of thing. And if they are not educated in Jamaica because street children don't go to school, then they won't have a chance or have that opportunity to come to the U.S. to further their education.
Uh-huh. Hari Acharya is sitting next to you, born in 1973 in southern Bhutan to a farmer's family. Where is Bhutan?
Bhutan is a very, very small country in the Himalayas between India and China. So it has a contiguous border with India on the east, west, and the south, and in the northeast, the Tibetan region of China.
Now, you were forcefully evicted from Bhutan in 1992. Why?
Bhutan came up with ethnically discriminatory policies, requiring all the people to wear a single dress, follow a single culture in the late 80s, and my father was one of the people in the village who objected to this policy, and my family was forcefully evicted because of the same reason.
Who runs Bhutan?
Bhutan is an absolute monarchy. It is run by a king named Jigme Singye Wangchuk. The monarchy was begun in 1907, and now it's 93 years old.
And what kind of work did you do there and since you have been forced out?
Inside Bhutan, I was not very, very active in any human rights work because, like, I was not aware that anything like human rights or democracy existed. But once I was outside the country, I joined a human rights organization, and we worked with the torture victims, counseling the torture victims, getting down their depositions, working with the same organization to get the depositions of human rights abuses inside Bhutan. And also I helped in the publication of a quarterly newsletter of the youth organization of Bhutan, with whom I'm working now. And also I published a booklet in 1998 about the crisis in Bhutan. So basically it's human rights works and advocacy for the repatriation of refugees from Nepal to Bhutan. That's what I have been working on since then.
And what do you think needs to happen to improve the situation?
I believe that the process needs to be resolved peacefully, and my people have been struggling for the last 10 years in a peaceful manner to get back to Bhutan. And I believe that the international community really needs to pressurize the government of Bhutan to take back the people. And also India as a great, as a big neighbor, a powerful neighbor, and also as the country that advises Bhutan on its external affairs, needs to get into the bilateral talks going on between India, between Nepal and Bhutan. And thus, India should help resolve this crisis.
I think Bhutan is a place people rarely hear about in the United States. Finally, Jennifer Close, you're executive director of Global Youth Connect, which has brought these people together in the United States. What is your goal here? And tell us what Global Youth Connect is.
Well, as you mentioned in the beginning, young people are at the forefront of most social movements, but yet they find it very hard to connect with each other and to learn from each other and share their experience. You know, what's happening with Annie in Nigeria and what's happening with Hari in Bhutan and Vondri in Jamaica. These issues are linked, and it's important to bring young people together to talk about their experiences, what works, what doesn't work, and to support each other, because we often as young people feel very alone and isolated in the work that we do. And so it's very important for us as young people to build a global movement. And so Global Youth Connect was formed in order to help provide additional training and support to young people around the world and to really build a community of human rights activists to move the movement forward.
And so what are you doing here? Where are you going?
Right now, we're in the process of a 10-day learning community. These four activists are only four of 13 young people we've brought together for 10 days to share their experiences. And afterwards, we hope to develop continuing support, training, newsletters, ways to keep the connections going so that people know that if Annie knows that if she has a question about something that might relate to work Vondri will do, she can call her up and ask her and know that she'll be there to support her no matter what's happening. Because it's not just about the work, it's about who we are as people, and that it's important that we feel supported as people so we don't burn out as activists. And so it's extremely important that we connect up with people who are doing similar things and think the same way that we do, and who can say, you know what, Annie, you need to take a break.
How do people get in touch with Global Youth Connect?
You can visit our website at www.globalyouthconnect.org and learn more about our organization, and it has all our contact information there.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. When we come back, just want to ask Annie Brisby, what got you involved with activism as a person who's gone to school in Nigeria, you could have worked for a corporation, why you choose to stay in the Niger Delta and be an environmentalist? You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Then we'll go to Durban, South Africa to talk about women and AIDS. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Annie Brisby from the Niger Delta, one of the group of young people here in the United States for training as activists. But Annie, you've been doing it now for years. How old are you?
28 now.
You're
28 years old.
How did you get involved with this kind of activism? When did you start?
I want to believe that I had the instinct right from when I was in secondary school. I was born in Lagos. And I attended schools in Lagos, my primary and secondary school. When I was in I used to go to the village once in a while with my family. When I attended sometime in school, I remember I was one of the most active students, and I realized that with all my activities, I was the only student who represented my school in the country in international sports like handball. And I represented the country in Sweden and Denmark at the age of 13. But I was not recognized for my efforts, you know. And I know that if I was to be from one of the majority tribes, I would have gotten a scholarship to go to the university, you know. And nobody really wanted to know where I was from. That was when I realized that where I came from didn't mean anything to anyone. You know, and it was so disheartening because I was like, I don't belong here. Being a Nigerian and not being recognized, because I know a lot of other people from the majority tribes that had you know, done some other things in school, like in academics and all that, were recognized.
What ethnic group are you with?
I'm from the Ijaw ethnic nationality, from the minority area of the Niger Delta region. You know, and that was one of the first, you know, instincts I had. I decided to go to the Niger Delta region for my university career. And before then, when I go to my local community, it's more like, I mean, I was very fortunate to have even, you know, school in Lagos, because a lot of my cousins, my elder brother who schooled in the local community, it was, the life was so low. And for me, it was like, this is unbelievable. I mean, there are two different regions. This is Lagos. This is my local community. You can't drink water. There's no drinking water. You have to drink from the river where all the wastes go into. There's no power. And the students in school have to read with candles. And we write the same national exams with students in good schools in other parts of Nigeria. And we noticed also that what I was used to when I go to the local communities when I was much younger, like the forest, you know, and the local herbs, you know, the traditional bed attendants use, everything was practically just dying out, you know. And I also noticed that my grandmother used to complain about not being able to get fishes anymore because of the oil spills and sicknesses. Because my community in 1998 had about more than 1,000 deaths of little children because of cholera. And this, they related to the water problem, you know, and we don't have health facilities. And this is the same thing with most of the local communities in the Niger Delta region. I mean, it was so, I was like, how can I grow in a community like this? It's so shameful. And apart from that, the people know nothing about modern civilization or even the civilization in the state, and yet we produce so much. You know, and that was what really...
You're talking about oil. Now.
Yes, I'm talking about the oil, and that was what really pushed me into, like, if as long as I live, I must, you know, work with other activists in the region to change the life of the people in my local community.
When Jeremy and I met you in the Niger Delta, you stood out as an activist, but also as one of the only women who were at the forefront. What is it like to be a young woman?
Like you rightly said, a lot of young women in the Niger Delta region after graduation would prefer to work with multinationals or to work with the banks, you know, and it's so difficult to, like, make them understand that, look, these issues are very important, but as long as they are comfortable, you know, it's more like, oh, I'm sorry, I don't want to get my fingers stained, you know. But when I started, it was more like a belief. It was like I saw it, you know, and it was more like if I don't get involved, I would regret it the rest of my life. It's not really been easy, you know, to be very sensitive. Activists have to, like, work so hard, and we have to, like, scratch the floor a lot before we eat, you know. But the most important thing is you're fighting the cause, and the cause you believe very much in. So, but in recent times, we've had so many women coming into, going into the activities and also adding their voices, which has been a plus since we started.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Katerina Cherepaka from the Ukraine, from the International Women's Rights Center, La Strada, Ukraine. Vandria Thompson from St. Catherine, Jamaica. Hari Acharya from Bhutan. And Jennifer Close, head of Global Youth Connect. Again, you can go to the web at www.globalyouthconnect.org, or you can call the organization in New York. We're going to go back now to Durban, South Africa. And, of course, Annie Brisby, thanks for being with us from the Niger Delta. Annie Brisby, who heads up the group Niger Delta Women for Justice. In South Africa right now, the International AIDS Conference is taking place, the 13th annual conference. And one of the major issues is women and AIDS. Joining us in the studio at the International Media Center at the Durban Conference is Lori Heise, who is director of the Microbicide Development Fund and co-founder of the Global Campaign for HIV Prevention Alternatives. Lori, welcome to Democracy Now! Lori, are you there? Well, we'll go to a short music break, and we'll try to get her on the line. And I think we have Lori Heise on the line with us from Durban, South Africa. Lori, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me.
Well, I just introduced you as the co-founder of the Global Campaign for HIV Prevention Alternatives. First, let's talk about the overall issue of women and AIDS, a massive issue, to say the least. But how are women and AIDS being talked about at the conference?
Well, actually, for the first time, I think we're seeing women from Africa and from southern countries in positions of leadership here at the conference. In fact, my colleague is just coming in the door because she's come from a major meeting of the Society of Women and AIDS in Africa, and therefore she's a little late. I would say that we had this morning a plenary meeting or plenary presentation that spoke about gender, sexuality, and the need to really deal with women's lack of power in sexual relationships and how in many ways our current AIDS strategies have failed women in terms of giving them the tools, both in terms of power and in terms of technology, that would allow them to actually protect themselves from this fatal disease.
You've been focusing on microbicides. For people who have never heard of them, explain why this is becoming such a major issue, and particularly for women.
Well, basically a microbicide, it's kind of a scary word. We wish we could find a better one. It just refers to a new class of compounds that women could use vaginally to protect themselves from HIV and other STDs. The closest thing you and I might be familiar with is kind of a spermicide from the days when spermicides were more commonly used as contraceptives. The new generation of microbicides are still in development. They don't yet exist. But it would be for the first time that something women could use without their partner's knowledge or cooperation. And so for the first time, it would put control back into the hands of women.
And how is it being dealt with at the conference?
Well, actually, there's a lot of events here. Unfortunately, microbicide research and the whole issue about women's prevention needs has, in effect, been basically the poor stepchild, I guess, of the other research areas. Women are now organizing internationally, and that's what the global campaign is, in order to try to raise awareness about the fact that current prevention strategies are leaving women vulnerable to infection, and that we need more investment. And current investment is incredibly low into the prevention needs of women.
As you said, you've just been joined by another woman, Portia Joyce, who is with HIV-positive women from Johannesburg. Is that right?
Yes. Portia is here with us today.
Portia, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You've just come from a major meeting.
Yes.
You are HIV positive. You're at the conference. Can you talk about what this conference means to you?
This conference means a lot to me because I mean, I've been meeting a lot of people from all over the country, and I've been able to talk to them about HIV, AIDS, and some of them, they are one of us. And I'll be getting a lot of different advice from the different places. Hoping to go somewhere end of the month, like and join the ICW. It's an organization for women, so I'll earn more than what I know.
What is ICW?
It's an organization for women who are HIV positive.
How are women who are HIV positive treated in South Africa? What is it like for you in Johannesburg?
Actually, here in South Africa, we are women who are HIV positive. They're treated differently, bad. Like, as you heard about Gugu Dlamini, the woman from KwaZulu-Natal who was stoned to death, because she came out that she told the people that she's HIV positive. And now women are scared to talk about HIV, their HIV status because of that. And some of them we have in the support group, they broke up with their husbands and boyfriends just because they told them that they're HIV positive. Or maybe the husband or boyfriend happened to find out that the baby died of HIV AIDS. Then when the husband comes home or whoever, boyfriends, then they start fighting about this thing. And the men, they're blaming us, that they say it's us that who are in, came with this AIDS thing. And they don't understand that it's only that, a woman goes to, when a woman is pregnant and she have to be tested before him. When a woman is tested before the man, they think just because you tested before the man, then you are the one got the virus first. Then they're not aware that there are also the AIDS carriers.
What about access to information? What kind of access do you have, and is it different in the townships than in the cities?
Yeah, it's different in the towns and in the cities. Like, I can say women, they've got a lot of information, but they can't talk to the husbands or boyfriend about this information, like negotiating condom and all this STD stuff. They get blamed, so it's like they know nothing about this HIV AIDS and STD things.
And what kind of access do you have to medicine?
Actually, we don't have the access to medicine at the moment. As there's TAC, Treatment Action Campaign, I'm also a part of that. We are asking the government and the pharmaceutical companies to, bring the price low. And even though we know this antiviral things and AZT, they are not going to cure the AIDS. But what we know that it's they are going to help a positive woman who is pregnant, then the baby will be negative. And other thing, what we know that a positive person, if they take their drugs, and they can live longer. But from my side, I'm not taking anything. So I don't know.
Why not?
I just told myself that I'm not going to take anything. I'm born to we were born to die. So I just believe in myself that I'm just Portia, and when my time comes, I will go. Like as the when I was told that I'm HIV positive, 1992, the doctor just told me I've got 3 weeks to live. And up until now, I've never been sick. So something just told me, no, don't take anything. And I don't even like feel for these drugs, whatever, when people say, do you want to go on trials? No, I don't feel like going on trials.
Portia Joyce, we have to end the program. Thank you for being with us. Lori Heise as well, Director of Microbicide Development Fund. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jeremy Scahill. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York, speaking with Durban, South Africa. Thanks for listening. Spring is deep within.
In the theory of the United States, a corporation cannot exercise the authority and the power of governance. It's not a sovereign entity. It's a creation of the state.